Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 48 of Supermates, the husband and wife geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And apparently I can't talk today because it took me like 3 times to spit that out.
Oh, it was more than 3, sweetheart.
And you think as many times as we've done this, which actually this will be our second anniversary episode.
Hmm.
And we're not making a big deal out of it this time because we're going to do a big 50th episode.
Hmm.
So
episode
number 50. So this is actually Lady's Choice today. This mm-hmm. was something you wanted to cover.
And honestly, it was one of those cases that after we talked about it, I kind of regret it. And you'll understand why afterwards.
I kind of regret it too. Oh, that makes me, people that listen, are like, this makes me want to listen. You came to me and said, hey, why don't we cover the DC Bombshells comic? Because you've been getting it.
I had been getting it, and I had read the first 2 issues. But I hadn't had a chance. We had gotten the issues, but I hadn't had a chance to sit down and read through them yet.
Oh, okay.
Until after we had already made the decision to do this.
See, I didn't know that till just now.
Yeah, so.
Oh, okay. Well, in case people aren't familiar with it, you want to tell them what DC Bombshells
sure.
is?
DC Bombshells, and some of this I did some research on just so I would have the correct terminology and the right dates and all that good stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
DC Bombshells is an alternate reality where, according to a press release from the company, superpowered female heroes are on the front lines in World War II. It was originally created as a series of statuettes inspired by 1940s pinup art and diesel punk. Diesel punk is a genre similar to that of its more well-known cousin, steampunk, that combines the aesthetics of the diesel-based technology of the interwar period through the 1950s with retro-futuristic technology and postmodern sensibilities. It later sparked 2 runs of themed variant covers, first in August of 14 and then again in October of 2015, this time to coincide with the launch of their own series, DC Comics Bombshells Volume 1. But Bombshells doesn't just feature Batwoman, Wonder Woman, and Supergirl kicking butt. It also explores their alter egos when the masks come off. And I actually found part of an interview. Well, I'm going to talk about part of an interview where the Huffington Post chatted with the comics writer Margaret Bennett and artist Margaret, and I'm not sure exactly if I'm saying
Marguerite,
this. Marguerite,
I guess.
Marguerite, yeah.
Yeah, they're both Marguerites, which is weird.
And the artist's last name is S-A-U-V-A-G-E.
Savage?
Savage, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Bennett went on to say, I know they will love the art, so I don't even have to hope for that. I hope they enjoy our conceit that no heroine in this universe is derivative of a male counterpart. I hope they also enjoy the game we're playing with each heroine beginning in her own story. I wanted to have the art and media of the era influence each woman and her saga individually. Batwoman is a pulp radio serial. Wonder Woman is a war story. Supergirl and Stargirl are in a propaganda reel. Zatanna is in a Hammer film. Catwoman is in a noir. Harley Quinn is a Looney Tunes farce. Aquawoman is in a romance. I hope that there's something for everyone, dark to light, and everything in between.
Okay. And this, the designs of the statues are based on the art of a guy named Aunt Lucia,
mm-hmm.
who apparently already kind of, he's done a lot of commercial art, but he tends to go into that good girl pinup art style anyway. So I was doing a little research on my own, and that's who the statues are based on. And there's a lot of product out there now, not mm-hmm. besides the statue. Like we're looking, there's a calendar on her wall
right.
that's from it. So this has become like its own little... little
cottage industry, yeah.
subset of DC. They had the Amakami a few years back, mm-hmm. the manga anime style DC heroines, and so this is another another treatment of it. DC Comics Bombshells number 1 was dated October 2015. These were all actually digital first, mm-hmm. weren't they? They were
right.
So it's a case where, you know, there's several chapters, and then they'll collect it in a regular format comic. But the print copy is dated October 2015. The writer was Marguerite Bennett, as we said. Marguerite Savage was the artist. Wes Abbott, the letterer. Aunt Lucia did the cover. And he does the cover for all of these. So he is the designer of the series and the characters, and he's doing the covers. Jessica Chen is associate editor. Jim Chadwick is group editor.
This particular issue and most of these issues, they're presented in standalone parts.
Right.
And this first issue is in three parts. The first part introduces us to Batwoman, who is a socialite, a masked baseball player, and her name is Kate Kane, and her partner is Maggie Sawyer, who fills in kind of like the police commissioner, like as a Jim Gordon type.
Mm-hmm.
Kate is bored with her current state of being a vigilante. The last panel of part one shows us Amanda Waller coming in via airplane, where she's landed on their apartment building roof to recruit Kate to end the war.
Okay.
Part two is Steve Trevor and his comrades are flying off the coast of Greece when they manage to invade Themyscira airspace and are attacked by Diana and her band of fellow warriors. Trevor is the only one to survive, and he is taken into custody. Part three takes place in Moscow, and we are introduced to Courtney Gudyanova and her sister Kara, who have left their village to become night witches, which are female airplane pilots. It was Courtney's idea to come to Moscow, and Kara followed her out of duty for her sister. As they are walking through Moscow, they are approached by a young soldier who tries a pathetic come-on, and Kara knocks him out with a flick of her fingers. When they arrive at the airfield, we found out that their father is an ex-cosmonaut. When they are airborne, there is a malfunction, and in order to save Courtney's life, Kara must exhibit her powers, leading them to be arrested as traitors as the first issue ends.
You know, just, I mean, even from reading the first issue, I really like the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
That Marguerite Savage, unfortunately, she does not stick around long, even through these first six issues, which is a shame. Her art style fits the designs well.
Mm-hmm.
It fits the period fairly well. It has kind of an animated look about it, but it's like a lot of modern comic art. The color does a lot of the work. It's, you notice she's listed as artist, so I'm assuming she's doing the coloring too.
Right.
Which is common, and the inking and everything nowadays. I'm sure it was all done digitally anyway. The only complaint about the art is that it is somewhat hard to follow. Like you
yes.
and me were talking, it's easier to follow than some of the later issues by other artists. But you and me were like, when the Amazons attack Steve and his men because mm-hmm. they are invading their airspace, I thought that he was engaging the German pilots, Nazi planes, had engaged them. And you and me were talking, you were like, well, I wasn't sure because...
The way it is, I just thought maybe they just accidentally crossed into their airspace and they were fleeing from an earlier firefight.
Right.
I didn't think that there was one going on. It's just not clear.
It's not clear. And
I think a lot of the problem is... They are not doing justice. I mean, I understand they're doing diesel punk, but at the same time, they're not looking at their source material as from where they're at. It should be clear, you know, there's actual images from German planes. There's actual images from American planes. And look at the actual source material. Look at the actual time period. I mean, I understand that you're not, there's going to be differences, but at the same time, it should be clear. I just wasn't happy with that. It's so easy to pull images.
Yeah, nowadays it's just, Google Images and bam, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be comic artists had to keep clip magazines and
mm-hmm.
keep file. I mean, you hear about writers and artists who kept just folders and folders full of reference material. And now this one, I don't think that there's anything. The planes and stuff look pretty authentic as drawn by Savage. As the issues go along, and I will bring up one instance, I just like slapped my forehead. It was so bad.
Oh, I know. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah,
we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. But I'll be honest. I mean, I almost hate to get into it at this point, but I think we pretty much let the cat out of the bag that we weren't blown over by this series. Just the fact that the statues are so fun. They're just this exuberant, joyful. All the women are smiling. You know, Wonder Woman's like busting chains. She's like Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a definite I'm Rosie the Riveter meets Wonder Woman meets pinup
art. I mean, her tiara is a headband.
Right. It's a scarf. Yeah. Just tied behind her head. And which, you know, you're getting into an even darker, a pretty dark interpretation of the standard Wonder Woman origin by, you know, with Steve and the way the Amazons are toward the men. And even more so than they normally are, than like, you know, we covered the second Wonder Woman pilot on here that pretty much redid the story over again, mm-hmm. where, you know, she brings Steve to the, you know, up to, you know, he comes up on shore and they save him and everything. So, I mean, to me, going deep into the Wonder Woman origin story, and it's not even that altered, was a mistake. I mean, Batwoman is, she's dressed in like a female softball outfit.
Baseball.
I know it's baseball, but it's think of a league of their own.
That's, yeah.
It's a league of their own meets Batwoman's outfit. Mm-hmm. That's her look. Mm-hmm. And she's also Kate Kane socialite. Okay, she's a crime fighter that's also a masked baseball player. Mm-hmm. And she's a socialite. Okay, that concept is so crazy that there's no point in trying to do it in a serious way.
No.
I mean, to me, it's like this should have been a very bombastic, you know, nutso, balls to the wall, let's stick it to the axis.
Yeah.
Action adventure romp, you know, this whole series. Mm-hmm. It's not fun enough. That's the problem. And we'll get even further into it. But the Wonder Woman part's the first part where I'm like, and then the Supergirl and Stargirl thing is just weird. I don't know if somebody had, you know, Superman Red Sun on their mind. I guess they had to come from somewhere else to the show that. I mean, one thing about this, you know, that you get is that the U.S. entered World War II earlier.
Right.
This is 1940, and we're already involved. Mm-hmm. And we were one of the first countries to get involved. So this is rewriting history, mm-hmm. not just dropping the superheroes into it, and more specifically superheroines and no superheroes as far as males,
right.
male superheroes that we've seen yet. You know, there's cute little things in it, like we see Batwoman save a family that comes out of the Mark of Zorro.
Zorro, yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the Waynes, and you know the different things like that. I kind of even understand the entering World War II earlier, so it gives the women, and it mentions that the women have entered the workforce. They've taken the mm-hmm. place of the men who are overseas, which of course happened in real life.
Oh yeah.
And this gives them more time to do that. So we're up to speed more with them. They're more, and it gives them more time to become more fully integrated than by the time the men come home. And then all of a sudden the women lose ground because they're expected to go start making babies, you know? So, I mean, you know, but, and I appreciate that. And, you know, the fact that they carry over the Kate Kane, Maggie Sawyer relationship is fine from the modern comics, of course. And, you know, I like Amanda Waller. She, you know, she's not like the overly obese Amanda Waller, but she's a little chunky, but curvy in her little aviator outfit. It's cute, you know? I mean, there's aspects of it I like, but I just wasn't expecting, I was expecting more of a just
fun time.
Crazy girl power, fun, you know, just.
See, that was what I went into it with. I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. This is going to be fun. And then, you know, we're introduced to, you know, all of the crap with Zatanna and the Joker's daughter, which we're going to talk about.
We haven't got there yet.
I know, but still.
Ooh. Yeah. And, you know, you get things like I said, Supergirl and Stargirl are sisters. They're like mm-hmm. half sisters. Supergirl's the adopted sister.
Yes,
but it's oddly similar to the current Supergirl TV show where she
suddenly I thought
got
too,
a sister,
yeah.
which is kind of weird. Mm-hmm. But it's Courtney, you know, Stargirl. I mean, a reimagined version. And you know, the one thing, you know, you get other DC characters peppered throughout, like Anton Arcane is a general in the Russian army.
Mm-hmm.
And his name's spelled different, but that's Swamp Thing's enemy, Anton
right.
Arcane, you know. The deal with the Night Witches, the stuff with the Supergirl and Courtney part, it's like they gave you all this exposition on the Wonder Woman part that you really didn't need, because almost anybody reading it, that's Wonder Woman's origin.
Right.
I mean, it's not that different.
No.
But they drop you right into the middle of the Supergirl, Stargirl thing, which those characters have never been connected.
No.
They're from Russia. They're in the middle of this, they mentioned a cosmonaut program, so
mm-hmm.
there were cosmonauts already, which is, okay, that's interesting. There was a space program in the 40s.
I know.
They just drop it like, our father was a cosmonaut.
But, and it was past, like it had been like 20 years before
He was
that.
Like a disgraced cosmonaut, we find out, that was like basically labeled a traitor. And it's like,
so that happened in the 1915s, 1920s,
Or something. Yeah. Because
if this is 1940, you know.
Right. I mean, there's just things that just, you're dropped into this very different take, and it's just not, I don't know. They're going really deep into this own created universe, which I don't even think they really needed to. But then they're still not giving you enough information to fully comprehend what's going on.
To be integrated completely.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into the next issue.
Okay. So DC Comics Bombshells #2, November of 2015. Same creative team, except for art by Laura Braga, Stephen Mooney, and Ted Nephi?
I guess.
Issue 2 opens with Wonder Woman caring for Steve, who is healing bodily, but is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which he refers to as battle fatigue. Diana approaches her mother with the plea to help Steve's people, to which Hippolyta responds that a policy of isolationism is the answer. As Diana leaves, she overhears that Steve is to be executed in the morning. As Diana walks along the beach, Mira, an established friend to Diana, arrives in her dolphin-drawn chariot, which, let's just be honest, that's just pretty.
Yeah, I mean, that part's cool.
Yeah. She and Diana decide to break Steve out of jail and join the war effort. Diana for justice, Mira for adventure, romance, and excitement. The second part of this issue has Courtney and Kara becoming propaganda tools for Russia, Supergirl, and Stargirl. And the third part shifts to Berlin, Germany, and the nightclub of the Joker's daughter. Red hair and nasty teeth in a bustier. Ugh.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I just have to put that in there because it's just gross. Zatanna is the performer, and John Constantine is in the audience disguised as a high-level SS officer, which results in Constantine being turned into a rabbit of all things. Zatanna keeps him from the clutches of the Nazis by promising she can do worse than they could to the hapless rabbit spy. The Joker's daughter keeps Zatanna in line by blackmailing her with the threat of revealing the fact of her being Jewish.
Yeah, you know, I should have mentioned, I talked about the cover. The cover to issue #1, which I failed to mention, is really cool. I mean, it's like we said, it's gorgeous. You got Wonder Woman on a motorcycle, Supergirl's flying, and Batwoman's leaping. You know, she's got a bat in her hand. Again, she's dressed like a baseball player. And, you know, you got planes flying. And it says, United for Victory. Well, you know, that doesn't happen in this issue. Because they don't get you. We're not going to get united by the time we get done here, kids. Not completely. The second one has Wonder Woman and Mira riding on top of the dolphin. There's like this. There's like a the chariot that's carried by the dolphins,
mm-hmm.
and it's beautiful. You know, it's gorgeous. Again, this is fun. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's nuts. You know, and I really like it. So, you know, again, we're in on the Wonder Woman origin that doesn't seem to match the character on the cover. It's like the Wonder Woman with her hair back in the scarf. And the, you know, Rosie the Riveter kind of outfit just doesn't seem to match this very serious take on Wonder Woman we're getting here. You know,
no.
It just doesn't seem to work. I do like Mira and Wonder Woman being pals. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, I do too. Because, you know, if you remember back in the old stories when Wonder Girl existed on Themyscira and everything else, she had a friend in Merboy and stuff
right.
like that. So
yeah.
It's kind of like...
Yeah, and they've hinted before that, you know, there's been stories where Aquaman and Wonder Woman met when they were younger and things, so
mm-hmm.
you know, it makes sense. I gotta say, I hate to be this way, and I hate to just pick apart
things.
I hate to be negative, but the art in the Supergirl segment in this issue is just really amateurish. None of the characters are recognizable from the last issue. if it weren't for the word balloons, I'd have to wonder if the wrong pages got inserted to this comic.
Right.
I mean, it's just, it's like, who are these people? You know, it's, I just don't get it. And I know, unfortunately, that's an unfortunate thing about the digital comics, which we've run into with Wonder Woman 77 when we reviewed it, mm-hmm. is that they're just, they're done in chapters. And there's like, you know, an artist will do, I mean, a lot of comics are done that way, but it just seems the digital comics are done that way. I don't know if it's just where they're not a high priority or what it is, but it's like an artist will do about 7 or 8 pages, another artist will do 7 or 8 pages, and I swear sometimes it looks like one they're working probably at the same time. They're not looking at each other's pages.
No. Uh-huh.
And they don't match. So this might not be this artist's fault, really. They might not have anything to go by.
Right.
So, you know, I don't mean to pick on people. And, you know, and I will say, I mean, I'm not a professional comic artist by any means, but I have drawn comics. And I do know storytelling, and you know, I've obviously studied comic art and stuff. So when I'm picking at people, I'm not trying to come from an uneducated, you know, angle. I'm just telling you, as somebody who's read comics for years and has drawn a few, I can tell you, I can't follow what's going on.
I know.
And if I can't follow what's going on, then the common reader probably can't follow what's going on.
Well, and as a librarian, one of the things I look for when I buy books for the library, and I mean, I'm buying, you know, spending thousands of dollars every year, and I look for a clear story. This isn't it.
No. I mean, one thing that jumps out at me in that Supergirl segment is that, you know, the Night Witches in the previous issue turn on Kara and Courtney because Kara has her, you know, she has superpowers. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, automatically, you know, she's suspect. They think she might be the German Ubermensch or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. And so she shows them that, no, we can, you know, we will fight for Russia, for Mother Russia. And she heat visions this really impressive mural into the wall.
I mean...
of her and Courtney decked out in the costumes they'll wear mm-hmm. for the rest of these first few issues. And I'm thinking, wow, she's one hell of an artist because she got the color in there and everything.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, if they just had her etch it in there very crudely, I could say, I could kind of see her pulling that off.
It almost looks like a mosaic.
Yeah, it does. It's like, did she go and assemble tiles just... like at super speed.
And, yeah, it looks like a mosaic.
Which maybe she did, but I mean, if they'd shown a panel of that, but yeah. as it stands now, it's like, it's almost like, you know, it's like a Great Wall of China vision from Superman 4. You know, that's what it looks like to me, you know. I mean, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, the Zatanna segment, nothing against our pal Ryan Daly, who's getting ready to launch Power Fishnets now with Black Canary. And Zatanna, or Zatanna, which we've never decided how we want to say it. But the Zatanna segments in this whole series...
That, I'm sorry,
they just are Captain Bring Down.
They are. I mean, she's pretty on her own. Zatanna is pretty on her own in her little outfit, but the whole rest of it, I'm just like...
And the Joker's daughter with her... I know the Joker's daughter, I've seen artwork where, you know, in the modern comics, the Joker's daughter had the Joker's face where his face got cut off, and God, that... Oh, I hate that stuff. But, you know, and she's skanky looking and nasty. But, that, I mean, it's just like, how does this work with fit in with the pinup art thing? It's like, who wants that?
No.
You know, it's like...
It's supposed to be hot girls.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, geez. And it just, it's just really just, it's very dark. It's very almost like Vertigo-esque. Mm-hmm. It's like, how does that fit in with this? And then, of course, speaking of Vertigo-esque, John Constantine, who looks a lot like David Bowie. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
In this issue, which is oddly enough, unfortunately, since David Bowie
recently passed away.
Yeah, of course, he hadn't passed away when this first came out. But and now he's a rabbit, which that's fun.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, there's things where the fun comes through, but it's just you know, DC just can't have fun. You know, or usually we'll get to something fun later. Yeah. DC Comics Bombshell number 3 was dated December 2015. This time we had art by a returning Savage, Doug Garbank, and Wendy Broom. It opens with Batwoman giving a beatdown to a punk who sold the name of Jewish families trying to get out of Germany to the Nazis. A blue-haired,
what the hell,
in 1940, teenager in coveralls prevents her from being hit from behind. The teenager goes back to the garage where she works with Kathy, why another Kathy?
I know.
And Nell and formulates an idea that will require uniforms. The next scene opens with Kate Kane and Maggie Sawyer having a night out before Kate chips out. The next morning, Kate is introduced to Dr. Kimio Hoshi, Dr. Light, and Big Barda Free by Amanda Waller in the concept of the Bombshells, a covert agency made up of women. Kate is to be sent to Germany with La Contessa Celine Degatti, the Catwoman, to serve as her contact.
I really don't care for the parts with the Joker's daughter, and I've mentioned this before, and this one is no different. A group of unlucky Nazi soldiers are chosen to become the walking on undead, and we are introduced to Tenebus the Binder. Not only does the Joker's daughter have stanky icky teeth, she also has a blackened hand from contact with Tenebus.
Yeah, they summon this demon that looks like Venom's uglier brother.
Uh-huh.
It's really strange. It's like, okay. As Diana, Steve, and Mara travel, Steve and Diana compare the names of the stars from their respective worlds. As they come ashore, they come across a battle between the forces of General Samson Lane and the Nazis. Diana enters the fray, which ends with the Germans surrendering and Sam Lane calling for a message to be sent to Amanda Waller about a new bombshell.
Again, you know, the cover is wonderful. You know,
yeah,
not a standout, but still, you know.
Yeah, Zatanna is conjuring up. She's changing Constantine into a rabbit. And there's some smiling demon, which actually looks more like the Joker in the background, but it's not. Which I thought, oh, is the Joker in this?
Yeah, well, it kind of looks like the Joker of, you know, what version of it
Batman
was
Batman Beyond, Return of the Joker?
No, the
version, Batman?
The Batman. Yeah. It looks like him, that particular face.
A little bit, yeah. I can see that. You just see teeth and eyes, but it does kind of look like that one, yeah. It's nice to see Savage back, again, her art style suits what the book should be, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Their name actually is the Bombshells. That's fine. That's cool.
Yeah.
I didn't even get that the demon, the artwork is so muddy and murky in the Zatanna segment that I didn't even get that until the following issue that the demon infected the Joker's daughter's arm when he touched her. Because everything's so black anyway.
Right. I didn't realize that there was an effect until she... But that might have been the whole big reveal. That might have been...
Well, no. I think you're supposed to know it then. Because she does, like, scream or, you know, she has this awful look on her face. But, you know, everything was in such shadow that it, you know, I don't know. The battle scene with Wonder Woman was incredibly hard to follow. We're not even told there's U.S. troops there until... It's like, oh, General Lane. It's like, what, General Lane?
Well, and I'm just assuming that I didn't realize he was a U.S., U.S. Army until they said Sam Lane. I'm like, oh, well, he's got to be U.S.
Right.
There's no insignia that says that. I thought she had just come upon, you know, Nazis and they started firing at her. I didn't realize until after I went back and read it, like, for the third time, but, oh, that she came across a battle and, you know.
This is where... I mean, the U.S. troops don't look like U.S. troops. The German soldiers in some places kind of do, but not really. This is a case where, you know, like Captain America, the First Avenger, you know, they kind of sidestepped a lot of the Nazi stuff so they'd use Hydra and it wouldn't offend people or whatever, which, you know, I can argue about that if you want. But they still looked like of that, even though they had tech beyond the era.
Right.
Their uniforms and stuff still looked like an extrapolation of that era.
Mm-hmm.
It was still identifiable as a German World War II outfit.
Right.
You know, like a different division or something.
Right, 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 right.
Which is what it was supposed to be. And, you know, the Red Skull looked like a modified SS officer, which he was supposed to. That's all that needed to be done here, and it's just not. So,
DC Comics Bombshells #4 was on December of 2015, art by Bilquis Evely, Mirka Andolfo, and Laura Braga. Supergirl and Stargirl are being put to use as propaganda tools. They are commanded to kill, but they insist on disabling and capturing their opponents only. They are then sent against what they are told is a Nazi encampment, but with her super hearing, Kara is able to discern the truth, that it is a Soviet prison camp instead. They halt the battle and send their former handlers packing while coming to grips with the reality that they have been used. Our next stop is London, with Dr. Harlene Quinzel on duty at Arkham Ward for the criminally insane. She is called to the cell of Chandra Kingsolving, who warns her of dreams she's been having about Harlene. The statement seems to bring about Harlene's transformation into Harley, which I'm not sure why. But anyway, Harlene goes on. She transforms into the whole, you know, she looks like a deranged elf with complete
yeah,
with white
Christmas
face.
Outfit. Yeah.
She crashes a party where she picks up Pilot Hal. Is this Hal Jordan? We don't know. He's just referred to as Hal.
It doesn't look a damn thing like
and
Hal Jordan.
He's got black hair.
He looks kind of Asian, which is weird.
I don't know. She gets him to take her to the airfield where she steals his plane after knocking him out. Diana now has a costume courtesy of Amanda Waller. It's the same outfit that we've seen from the first issue, but she now finally has it in issue number 4. Steve is dealing with his post-traumatic stress disorder, but the other men are just calling him coward. Like, there is a vehicle that comes up, and he just hears the noise in the back of his head, and he's like, oh, get down. I mean, he's just reacting
right.
with, you know, what's typical
yeah.
of post-traumatic stress disorder. Then suddenly, there are Nazi prisoners that are brought into the camp, prisoners who surrendered. The other soldiers want to kill them, but Diana insists they will face trial. And she makes the U.S. soldiers say, no, you know, not do it. But because Diana has committed insurrection and she is also accused of desertion of duty in the field, Sam Lane sentences her to execution. And that ends the 4th issue.
Yeah. This one's got another great cover. Harley's riding on a bomb, mm-hmm. which actually, that's the next issue, which is weird. But she's wearing her traditional...
Yeah.
Bombshells costume, because they did a regular Harley statue, then they did a Christmas one.
Mm-hmm.
So she's wearing the Christmas one throughout most of this, but on the cover she's wearing the regular one, which is interesting. The Supergirl part isn't bad this time, but the propaganda art panels get a bit much, and it interrupts the flow of what's going on. It's mm-hmm. like it's almost like they're stopping and posing for a propaganda poster in the middle of all the action. I know that's supposed to represent that they are propaganda, but I don't know, it just could have
been handled better.
Yeah. Chandra Kingsolving. That is a bat blast from the past. She was the woman that Bruce Wayne suddenly fell madly in love with during Night Quest Nightfall.
Yeah. I thought that's who that was, but I didn't get a chance to ask you about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's who that was. And if she ever came back, I don't remember. If she did come back, let me know, because I haven't read the regular Batman books in years, so I don't know. So I'm with you. Did Harley put on makeup really fast, or did she just change, like magically change from regular face to clown face? The Harley part is like the kind of fun I wanted to have in this, but it's so out of nowhere. It's just, the other rest of the book's so serious it doesn't fit it.
I almost wonder, I mean, when I read this through again, I almost wonder if she's not maybe a split personality where the Joker is her other part. You know, like the way it read and the way the word balloons were, like maybe it was two different people that were talking to each other in her head.
Well, that way they could get around having a male, like her being a derivative character.
Right.
Because that said they're not going to do that.
So I was wondering, because if you look at the text and the font that they use, it's like she's having a conversation inside her own head.
Again, this isn't clear.
No, it's not clear. Again, this is just
an assumption
on my part, and it's just a theory.
Right. Like we said, Hal Jordan, but. So Wonder Woman is in her proper Bombshells outfit, but, you know, she says it's based on the planes. She points to the planes, the artwork on the planes. But to me, it doesn't fit the character they've established. I can't see her just deciding to wear that.
No.
Because she seems very serious and very, you know... Of course, I guess, you know, the traditional Wonder Woman outfit's pretty much a bathing suit, but it still seems kind of... Because they make this big deal about the fact that she went and got the tiara and the magic lasso, and she replaces the tiara with a scarf, which is kind of weird. Okay, this is where I'm like, no, man, do your research. There's an ambulance that pulls up by Steve Trevor,
which is what gives him the issue.
It looks like a 2004 or 5 minivan.
Yes.
It looks nothing like a vehicle in World War II.
No.
I mean, nothing. I mean, this looks like, if you go out into a parking lot right now, you're going to see this thing.
It's like an Odyssey.
Yeah, it's like, wow, okay. And again, it's really hard to tell which army is which. The U.S. soldiers look nothing like the real military. They look like the dudes out of Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's okay. You know, and then of course the Germans don't look German either. So I don't know. I hate to just keep being negative, but I gotta tells it like I sees it, and I just, you know, okay.
Okay. Our next issue is DC Comics Bombshells number 5, January of 2016. Art by Ming Doyle, Maraca Ondolfo, and Bilquis Evely. Kate Kane's boat is met by none other than Alexander Luther, who escorts her to Selina. However, Selina didn't send Lex to meet Kate. He just always seems to be one step ahead of Selina, and she can't figure out why. Selina leads Kate into a secret part of the club where Luther had brought her, where the Joker's daughter reanimates a dead soldier. Again, nasty.
Yeah. Harley's plane is shot down over France, and she lands in the greenhouse of none other than Pamela Isley.
How convenient.
Yeah, a black market smuggler who has recently turned herself green as an unexpected side effect of using perfume as a weapon to knock out German soldiers and later kill them. Isley also works as a supplier to Selina. France has fallen, and now the Nazis are coming for Isley. Harley proposes a partnership, and they are off to wreck mayhem. And as they walk away, you barely notice it, but there's some undead zombie Nazis that rise up that look really bad.
The thing is, though, this is the part that gets me. She said Isley tells Harley that she killed 3 German soldiers, and they're under her greenhouse. However, when they're going away, there's like 7 or 8 zombie soldiers. I don't know where they came from. I'm confused.
They're multiplying.
After liberating the Soviet prison camp that was disguised as a Nazi base, Courtney and Kara fly to their village to save their parents from General Arcane. He has indeed captured them, and Kara goes in to save them. However, things are not going so well until Alesovic, and excuse my pronunciation, I'm sure my Russian is not good, a swamp thing comes in, and Kara and Courtney are able to fly away with their parents. However, the Night Witches have answered Arcane's call and managed to capture the girl's father, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah. This cover is, on this one's more straight than others. You've got Wonder Woman, you know, she's walking in a battle setting, and she's deflecting some kind of energy blast off her bracelet, and it says, "We can do it," and she's got her fist, you know, she's doing the Rosie the Riveter from a different angle,
yeah.
Basically, which is cool. Again, the covers are the best part, sorry. So you get Lex, no Superman. But I have seen there's a Superman, there's like, I think it's a Power Girl statue, because Power Girl is not seen in these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one where like she's like lifting up, Superman's like a strong man with a handlebar mustache, and he looks like a circus strongman,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting because that's partially what his costume's based on. And they did that in the Time and Time Again.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that awesome Superman story? So the art in this part is very dark and heavy, and it doesn't suit the mood until we get to the Joker's daughter part again. Because, you know, the Kate, Lex, Selina stuff is kind of fun. It's kind of a, you know, James Bondian, almost kind of playful
right.
stuff back and forth. But the artwork's very dark. It's very just heavy blacks, and again, it's just not attractive. So Harley just happens to land in Poison Ivy's greenhouse. You know, I know comics and all stories are based on coincidence, but
that
just shoot her down right.
Hard.
I mean, she literally, now if she walked to it, if she was like a couple miles away or something,
yeah,
I think
something, yeah.
She like literally lands in it. It was like, okay. Where the hell did the Nazi zombies come from? I'm assuming, you know, these are the guys that Ivy killed, but yeah.
Again, how do you get suddenly 8 from 3?
And it's like somebody reminded the guy to draw the person. I don't know if it's man or woman. I don't know who drew what part. I didn't go into that depth of detail. You know, I just didn't. You know, the rest of this segment's fine, and the Ivy and Harley parts are actually there's kind of a fun, slightly animated, slightly Amanda Connor vibe
mm-hmm.
going on about it, and they're cute the way they draw them with their upturned noses and stuff. It's some of the better artwork in the series. But the last panel in that segment just shows these, I mean, it looks like they took like 5 minutes and drew, okay, here's a Nazi zombie. It looks like something like some teenager would draw in their, like, doodle
notebook,
in their notebook.
Yeah.
It's like, who phoned that in? You know, it's like, and it's like just left hanging there. It's like, is that supposed to be there? And we'll get, this comes back up barely later, which
yeah.
we'll get to. Arcane looks nothing like he did a few issues back in the famous...
I thought
it was somebody working for Arcane. No, yeah. It's him. I'm like, that doesn't look a thing like he did when Supergirl, you know, makes the Heat Vision mosaic, you know, in that scene. It's like, what? And then the biggest WTF of the whole series, Swamp Thing.
I know. I was like...
I know we've got Anton Arcane, but we have not mentioned... I know they've mentioned the wood sprites and the different Russian folklore.
Folk tales, yeah.
You know, that's great, and that's fine, but it's like we should have got more of a specific thing if they're going to bring out freaking Swamp Thing. He literally, they're in their cabin, and he literally like, rah, you know, shakes the house up, and there's this panel of everybody flying out of the house and soldiers falling everywhere and Swamp Things coming up out of the ground. And then there's one more panel of them, and they fly off. It's like... 2 second cameo by Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just
okay.
And then they're in biplanes for some reason. And I guess because so they can make this be a little more believable, they managed to catch their dad, Kara and
Courtney. But how did it not rip his arms off? I mean
I know that type of stuff happens in it's not like he leaped to his hand. It's like his hands were tied up and they grab him and it's just, yeah. Oh, let's get this over with. Go to number six.
Okay. DC Comics Bombshells number six. Cover date of February 2016. Art by Sandy Jarrell, Ming Doyle, Maria Laura Sinapo, and Mark Berry. The issue opens with Mira using her ocean friends to capture and destroy a German submarine. Mira is welcomed aboard, and it's clear the naval men think well of her. Soon, Courtney and Kara come along, shooting through the sky, and though there is a short battle, soon the three of them come to an understanding and actually listen to each other, and the girls tell their story. Mira welcomes them and their mother aboard.
Kate is in her guise as Batwoman and blows up a Nazi headquarters. She then comes across an underground swing kids club led by Helena, who is handy with the crossbow hidden in her instrument when it is set upon by the undead Tenebrae, which is the zombie stuff from the Joker's Daughter Zatanna segment. Mm-hmm. Turns out she's the leader of the German youth resistance, and she's also obviously an analog for the Huntress. Lex and Selena turn up to pick her up, and Kate gets in the car with Helena sneaking in the trunk. Lex then shares Luthor Corporation's newest discovery, a glowing green crystal.
Wonder what that is.
I don't know.
Amanda Waller, Big Barda, and Dr. Hoshi show up to rendezvous with Mira in the ship carrying Kara, Courtney, and their mother. Kara and Courtney are offered a place with the bombshells and new uniforms featuring the stars and stripes. Kara and Courtney agree to fight for Waller, but not as poster girls. They still love Russia, just not General Arcane and his way of running things. Kate, Lex, and Selena's car is rammed by Brother Knight as he wants to take Kate into custody. From the look on Kate's face, I don't think that's going to go so well for Brother Knight.
And Brother Knight was the guy that was in the nightclub thing with Zatanna and Joker's Daughter, which I guess we didn't bother to mention before because...
We're skipping that part
a
lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm skipping around a lot because these are presented just as one-page or two-page little spreads, and they're just,
It was very hard to try to make synopsized sense of this.
Yes, it was. The morning of Diana's ordered execution finds Steve and Diana in adjoining cells. Steve begs her to recant her actions and agree to follow General Lane's orders. Wonder Woman's response is to break her and Trevor out so that they can be worthy, that they can be heroes. We get a brief glimpse of Harley and Ivy taking out some Germans who are cutting down a Christmas tree. Now, here's the thing. Why would they cut down a Christmas tree? Because that's a Christian religious, you know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway.
I don't know.
The next thing we get to see is Zatanna talking to a tie-clad bunny version of Constantine and get a little rundown of their history.
Yeah. The cover is nice. I honestly really don't care much for the Catwoman design. I think it's just kind of bland and
it's not very cat.
I mean, if you go by the original design of Catwoman, she didn't wear a costume for several appearances, so I guess it kind of harkens back to that. But she's essentially just in a very nice evening gown with furs and and the gloves that go up to her biceps, but. But it's nice, and you know, see Batwoman walks in with her bat over her shoulder. But the submarine that Mara destroys, are those guys supposed to be the zombie?
I don't know. They're all glowy.
Electrical looking, and I mean, it's just like that comes out of nowhere. They don't do anything with it. She destroys it. Maybe it'll come back up in another issue, but it's like that comes from absolutely nowhere. And if it's supposed to be the other zombie undead people, it doesn't look enough like it for me to say yes, that's them.
Yeah.
Again, this artwork's not hanging together at all. So they do get Mara the floppy beach hat that we see in the statue, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, so that comes into the series finally, because the Mara one's a really nice design. I like that one a lot. And you know, okay, Supergirl and Stargirl fly in with their mom.
Mm-hmm.
Then they both get in a fight with Mira. Where's the mom during the fight?
I know, and they're in the middle of the ocean. I'm like, what the crap? Where'd Mama go?
I mean, if they showed,
was it a throw Mama from the train moment or what?
They showed her, put her in a bubble, like a energy bubble, or if she could do that with the cosmic rod. I don't know what she can do in this version. If Supergirl can, you know, make super art mosaics with her heat vision, why can't she make an energy bubble? I don't know. But, I mean, later they show her. It's like they forget to draw her, and then they remember to draw her. They show her on the ship later. It's like, oh, was there mom? At first I just assumed, oh, they dropped the mom off somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like, no, she's with them in some panels, and others
she's not. And you're like,
it's like the Super Friends. Like, you know, like Batman, Robin, and Green Lantern have been captured, and then shows them standing with him at the Hall of Justice in the next section.
You're like, what?
The storytelling action in the Batwoman Huntress section, again, is really poor. Huntress also looks like she's about 35 and she's supposed to be a teenager.
Oh, she looks older than Batwoman, Kate Kane.
It's like she doesn't look...
Now, I will say it was kind of neat. They do show her changing from Kate Kane, changing from her baseball outfit into an evening gown, which I thought that was kind of cool.
Harkening back to Barbara Gordon's original Batgirl outfit.
Yeah, I did like that.
That could flip down from her librarian gear to Batgirl, yeah. So did Stargirl use her staff to remake her and Supergirl's costumes? I mean, okay. Because they handed them... They had, like, very red uniforms before.
Yes.
And now they have very blue uniforms that, you know, that are somewhat similar to their... Supergirl, not so much, but Stargirl looks...
What I don't understand is they're like, oh, no, we're not going to wear our stars and stripes. But then Stargirl, hey, here's a big star on my chest. You know, I don't want to wear your star, but I'll wear this star.
Right, right.
What's the difference? And I got a big star on my tattooed... On her bicep.
Yeah, the tattoos really, you know.
At that time, that would not have been acceptable.
That's a concession to modern taste, which, you know, I get, you know, I guess I can understand that, but in the comics, it even makes less sense. Okay, Joker's daughter and her nasty teeth in this second story arc, which we should have mentioned that issues 1 through 3 are called Enlisted.
Uh-huh.
And then issues 4 through 6 are called Combat. Well, this should just really be one storyline. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no ending to Enlisted.
I mean,
there's really not a whole lot of an ending to this one, but you can kind of say, okay, it set them up for the next story. You know, you can kind of say that. So I can kind of see this being the end of the first storyline, which is why we ended here, because there's actually an additional issue we have. We just chose not to cover it, especially after reading these. The bombshell statues that they've yet to incorporate, I mentioned Power Girl. You have Black Canary, who looks like a singer, which they've actually done that in the current Black Canary series, which you can listen about on Ryan's Flowers and Fishnets episodes that are still out there. There's Hawk Girl, who has like a jetpack thing, yeah, which is cool. Batgirl, who looks like a parachutist. Power Girl, again, you know, I mentioned her. She looks like she's a circus strongwoman or something. Lois Lane, who looks like a newspaper.
Right.
She's like hawking newspapers. Cheetah, who looks like she's on safari. And Killer Frost, who's out skiing. She's a ski bunny, you know, which is cute. I really wanted to like this.
I assumed I would. I thought I would, too.
That's one reason I'm like, oh, this will be fun to do. So, we came to this with... You know, I had never really looked at the books. You bought them, and I hadn't really looked at them.
And like I said, I thought I'd told you that, but I had read the first two, and I was like, I just hadn't had a chance to sit down and read them because, you know, life, busyness, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had told you that idea, oh, why don't we do this? And then I sat down to read the rest of them, like, oh, why did we do this?
Well, it's like, again, because this is based on a series of collectibles, it's almost like a licensed property.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, you know, making a comic book off a toy or something. It's like somebody, you know, making a Minions comic and, you know, getting into the dark, you know, part of, like, you know, what does Gru really do to the Minions? And,
yeah.
You know, what does he torture them when they fail? And I mean, all the time, you know, I mean, it's like... It's fun. It's supposed to be. It's goofy. It's so. I mean, Batwoman she's a freaking baseball player. I mean, you know. I mean, just
right.
Goofy stuff like that. I mean, you shouldn't be trying this hard to make this a legitimately serious comic. It could be broad, fun, and just, you know, lots of bombastic craziness.
Yeah.
And that's what I was expecting, and I didn't get, and I never could get past it. And the reason I couldn't get past it is, besides that, I don't think that this comic really fits the subject matter. It's not that very well done, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's not... It's either... I mean, there's parts of it...
It's not cohesive.
It's not cohesive. There's parts of it that are... And I'm not trying to... You know, it's just not gelling. I'm not trying to disparage any of the creators on it. It's, for me, it's just not gelling together.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think part of it... is the, like we said, the lack of authentic period detail. You know, I was raised on the All-Star Squadron.
Right.
And they had their shit together. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Roy Thomas had every footnote you'd ever want. And I mean, I know, yes.
And that's another part. There is so much foreign language used throughout this comic that's not explained. I mean, you're like, unless you want... If you're not willing to take the time to look up Google Images to give me authentic framework, I'm not willing to go to Google Translate and figure out what the shit you just wrote.
A lot of songs that are in German and Russian. And it's like, yeah.
And I can hang and translate Spanish, okay.
Right.
I cannot speak it very well, but I can translate it fairly well after 4 years of Spanish. But anyway.
Yeah.
German and Russian? No.
Yeah.
Can't hang with that.
Right.
I just hate being so negative about this.
Too.
I really wanted to love this. I wanted to be like, yes, I'm going to do, you know, and I'm just like, I think I'm going to not have this pulled in my file anymore because I don't like it. Now I'm not spending $4 a book.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a cover price of $3.99 for a book that I'm just kind of like.
I like the covers.
Yeah, and I like the covers. And I can look those up on Google Images.
Yeah. Well, with that, I think that's a good place to stop. When we come back from our break here momentarily, we will have a much more positive review of a current comic.
Yes.
The Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast, in which four guys talk about romance comics and about romances in comics with Siskoid.
We're all French-Canadians here.
Marty.
In horror comics, there's often like this little, you know, romance tinge, I guess.
Okay.
Bass.
We just turned on him.
And yours truly, Fern.
I'm very aroused.
Featuring the overproduced wonder that is Romance Comics Theater every episode.
Dan,
I knew it couldn't last from the first day you eyeballed me when I reported to work. It wouldn't matter if I washed in laundry soap and came to work in a burlap sack. I'd turn you on. And you have the same effect on me.
I do?
The Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast, available at lonelyheartspodcast.wordpress.com and on iTunes.
We had a comic book romance.
Batman and Robin in Birds of a Feather.
Stealing the Statue of Liberty? Holy cow! Pigeon Woman will clip your wings.
The name's Pigeon Person, Robin. You imitation bird. You'll never stop me.
We'll see, you foul-feathered fiend.
Tomorrow we steal America's last statue. And an America without statues is an America without its past. Ha ha ha!
Batman and Robin confer at the Pentagon. The Batcomputer has plotted Pigeon Person's next plot. She plans to pluck Mount Rushmore.
We've got a counterplan, but we'll need your help.
You can depend on us. Will do, Batman.
There's Mount Rushmore, a setting duck, just waiting to be taken. Ha ha ha! No, not delicious Hostess Cupcakes Devil's Food Cake. Wonderful cream filling. My birds will do anything for that.
That's right. Even betray you.
Pigeon Person, get ready to have your feathers plucked.
Pigeon Person, you'll be caged for a long time.
Thanks to our planning and your own birds.
I can't blame my pigeons for betraying me. Even a bird brain knows that a Hostess cupcake in the beak is worth any two statues in the street.
You get a big delight in every bite of Hostess cupcakes.
Okay, we're back from our break. And, you know, originally the DC Bombshells was going to be what we were going to cover this episode. But I'm like, okay, we got to be positive here. And I'm thinking we've got to do something that I think we'll both enjoy. Or at least one of us will. I haven't talked to you about this. So, at the same time we picked up the last issue of Bombshells, we picked up Batman 66 number 30, cover dated February 2016, which unfortunately is the last regular issue of Batman 66, which just sucks. But, because that's the one regular comic I've been getting lately. January 12th of this year actually marked the 50th anniversary of Batman's television premiere, believe it or not. So,
and it was also the release date of Toner's version of the Yvonne Craig Batgirl. Gorgeous, gorgeous doll.
Which you have.
Which I have. They only made 500 of them, and it was worth every penny. I love that doll.
Yeah,
it is awesome.
It is
it's
awesome.
Sweet.
Yeah, it is awesome.
And if you look at my Facebook page, if we're friends on Facebook, you can see pictures of the doll there, because I've put it all over there, so.
Yep. The 13thDimension.com ran a 13-day celebration leading up to the premiere date. Our own Rob Kelly reviewed the Batman movie for the site, and then he had 13thDimension.com editor Dan Greenfield on Film and Water to discuss the movie, which you can find on the Fire and Water Network, which we are a part of course. The cover for issue number 30 is by Mike Allred and Laura Allred, who are husband and wife. He drew it, she colored it. It features a bevy of classic Batman merchandise, slightly redecoed in true Batman 66 style. Batman leaps off the classic lunchbox and punches Frank Gorshin's Riddler. As a bat collector, I love this cover. So they have me at the cover. You get the Aurora model kit. You get a pack of tops cards. You get the Ideal utility belt. You get the Aurora bat boat. You get the Captain Action Batman costume. You get a Ben Cooper mask. That's a can of crazy foam, which is back out now, by the way, behind the logo. The Batman squirt gun. You get a Pez dispenser. Batman Ideal puppets and Batman and Robin Soki figures. Get the Robin Aurora model kit. And you get the Japanese Batman
tin
wind-up toy robot. And you get the Batman and Robin society button, which I have. A lot of this stuff I have.
It was hilarious. I don't know if I told you this, but I was sitting on the couch the other night, and Danny came in and brought me this comic book. And she's like, look, Daddy has this and this and this and this.
Yeah.
She was pointing, you know, she was going, see, look, there it is, Mommy. See that? It's right there. See, here it is.
Yeah. So it's like it's our decor in our house just on a comic book cover.
Yeah.
So the story was written by Lee Allred, which is Mike Allred's brother. Art and cover, like we said.
So this is just a whole family affair.
Yeah, it's Allred's cover. Art and cover by Michael and Laura Allred. Letters by Wes Abbott,
who lettered the Bombshells book too, assistant editor David Pina, group editor Jim Chadwick, who was the editor of the Bombshells book, so he redeems himself here, Batman created, and it says this, by Bob Kane with Bill Finger.
Woohoo!
It says it in the book. I don't have to go and Bill Finger, damn it, anymore.
That's right.
Yay.
Yay, Athena Finger.
Yeah, yeah.
Your papaw's in there.
Yep. Another quiet day in Gotham City, perhaps too quiet. Commissioner Gordon and Chief O'Hara are flummoxed by the sudden disappearance of any and all criminal element in Gotham. While the two officials ponder the sudden lack of job security, the underworld is united at the Gotham Studios building, taking in a criminal convention ran by Joker, Penguin, and Catwoman. These master criminals are taking no chances this time, asking their attendees to come incognito, no costumes as they enter the convention. All the rogues are there, save the uninvited Riddler, shunned for his tendency to give away their plans via his compulsive conundrums.
At Gotham State Penitentiary, the Prince of Puzzlers gets wind of this and is beyond furious. He arranges for his flunky to make a delivery. Shortly thereafter, at Stately Wayne Manor, millionaire Bruce Wayne and his youthful ward, Dick Grayson, enjoy their downtime. Or more accurately, Bruce does, while Dick itches for action. Oh, he might need to take something.
God, I knew as soon as you read that, you'd say something. All right.
He soon gets it. Oh, my. As a bat phone call summons them into action as Batman and Robin.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
You're ready to move out.
At Police HQ, the dynamic duo find two film reels with a riddle attached to each. Deducing the puzzles Gordon and O'Hara could not, imagine that, the Cape Crusaders head out for the abandoned Greenway Studios to break up a crooked convention.
Arriving at the studio, their bat climb is interrupted by out-of-town reporters for the Daily Planet. They are to cover the studio sale to the Gotham Brothers conglomerate. On the roof, Batman recognizes their old foe, the Fox of the terrible trio, in his civilian guise. Batman uses the bat remote control to park the Batmobile in an ideal position for a later advantage, and they're off.
But the Fox was onto them, and he tips off the Joker, who prepares a welcoming committee for our heroes. He has Clayface assume the shape and color of a green screen, and soon the dynamic duo are duking it out in front of a familiar green background. Then the entire gallery of goons attacks en masse, but still the cowed Crusader and Boy Wonder fight on. Finally, a dog pile of deviants seems to have smothered the crime fighters. But fear not, for Batman activates his remote control, and the Batmobile comes crashing to the rescue, with Bat battering ram and Bat beam blazing.
With the entire convention contingent down, the Riddler appears to gloat about his victory over his former United Underworld comrades. Joker, Penguin, and Catwoman reciprocate the lack of honor among thieves and put the kibosh on their old partner. Just then, Batgirl rides in on her Batgirl cycle and takes out the big three. The visiting reporters, including a photographer named Peter and a late-arriving Clark Kent, question the masked Manhunter. But the humble Batman once again preaches the civic duty of all citizens, and soon he, Robin, and Batgirl are off once more to answer the bat signal. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Okay, I love this comic.
It was fun. It was really fun.
Mike Allred had drawn all the regular covers of the series and even the variant covers when Batman 66 took over the other DC titles for 1 month on variant covers. But I believe this is the first interior work on the series. I have the whole series, but I didn't go back and look through all of them. But I think this is the first one. The Allred trio had sort of kicked off the Batman 66-style comic with a story in the DC anthology Solo in issue number 7, December of 2005. There, a Batman very much like Adam West has to deal with life once his Robin goes all hippie and falls in love. Some of the crooks in this issue were only from the comics, although some of them were introduced into the 66 universe in the comic series. But you get guys like the Getaway Genius, Solomon Grundy, Catman, Polka Dot Man, King Cobra, who was in the animated opening, and Signal Man, among others. they reference the team up in the movie several times, you know, and Penguin's like, bat shark repellent ought to be a law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. I like the fact that they had the big three shun the Riddler. I mean, you know, they really did hate his riddles in the movie. They kept saying, you know, to make them more, not, you know, not so easily decipherable and everything. So this makes perfect sense, even if you ignore the weirdness with there being Julie Newmar here and it was Lee Merriweather there, which, you know. It's,
was that maybe just a likeness issue that they weren't able to?
No, I probably already wanted to draw Julie Newmar.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Most people do, you know, they prefer her, so. You can tell Allred is living the dream because he draws the Batmobile exit scene with the atomic batteries to power, turbines to speed, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much of it. He's like, you know, he's just, okay, I want to do everything that I ever wanted to do in dealing with the Batman TV show.
Yeah.
You know, and they just go, and with his brother writing it and his wife coloring it, they just go nuts. You know.
I mean, they did a great job. Yeah. It was wonderful. It really was. I liked it.
Of course, Greenway Studios were the producers of Batman.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, then you get Rob later on, Robin says, holy 20th century, the Fox of the Terrible Trio, which is a nod to 20th Century Fox, which was this big studio that produced the show. The part that made me go, whoa, was the cameo by Perry White, obviously John Hamilton, Jimmy Olsen, obviously Jack Larson, and Lois Lane, who is clearly Phyllis Coates, not Noelle Neal.
Why not?
From The Adventures of Superman.
Why not?
I don't know.
Maybe they just have a personal preference for Phyllis Coates. I like Noelle Neal.
Yeah, but, you know, there's everybody likes Noelle Neal because she's sweet and she's a sweet person in real life. Not that Phyllis Coates, I never met Phyllis Coates, so I don't know.
We did meet Noelle Neal.
Yeah, we did meet Noelle Neal. But Phyllis Coates was sexy, you know? She was the sexy Lois Lane of the 50s TV show. So okay. That might be it. Let's see what I was going to say. Yeah, Clayface actually becomes the green background from the animated opening of the, you know, and he recreates every bit of that animated opening frame by frame, which is awesome. And then you even get the Batmobile pulling closer, like at the very end of the title sequence. And I'm glad they got Batgirl to show up at the end. It wouldn't have been right to not have it without her, you know. And I thought it was funny some of the cameos you get, because you get Peter Parker.
Which is Marvel.
You get Jack Ryder, who, of course, the Creeper. You get Billy Batson. Mm-hmm. And you do get George Reeves Clark Kent. He shows up at the end. And it looks like George Reeves. But you pointed out something. I thought, oh, there's Van Williams as Britt Reed. And there's Kato beside him. But he doesn't say he's Britt Reed. He says what?
That he's Rit Breed.
So they
switch the letters.
Because I'm guessing they couldn't do it in this comic, even though they had them in the Batman Green Hornet Mini, but that was a co-publishing thing with Dynamite.
Right.
So they couldn't technically say that it was Britt Reed. But my mind read it Britt Reed because it looked like Van Williams.
Right.
And I wrote down it's Britt Reed, but you're like, it's not Britt Reed, it's Rit. Who's Rit? You said, who's Rit Breed?
Yeah, and I'm like, it just didn't.
And I said, it's Britt Reed. And you're like, no, it says Rit Breed. I said, oh, I said, that's the Green Hornet, but they spelled it wrong.
You know, and I thought that's what they, but I was like, maybe there was something I was missing, you know? I was like, well.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things to talk about, but just from the plot synopsis, you can see this is the type of last episode any Bat fan would have loved to have had.
Right.
I mean, just the final, like, you know, there's no way in the world they could have ever afforded to hire all the guest actors back. I mean, but it's just...
This is basically a thank you to the fans of the 66 series.
Yeah. And I mean, if you ever were able to... I mean, you know, it's a lot better than Zsa Zsa Gabor and the beauty parlor bit in Minerva Mayhem and Millionaires, which is the last episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they could have done this and just like, you know, let us do like, you know... I mean, that didn't happen back then. TV shows weren't self-referential back then, you know,
which
we've talked about that before. You know, like when me and Andy Leyland talked about one of the Star Trek annuals, it's it's a DC Star Trek annual from, I think it's number 2, I think, that's the final mission of the 5-year mission.
Mm.
And it's very, like, elements from the earliest stories come back. I mean, they go back to the Talosians in the cage. And it's, and me and him talked about even then in 1986 or whatever when that came out, that's probably more self-referential than they would be in the final episode back then. Even if they were allowed to end it, they wouldn't be that, you know, I don't know, that's just something that's more of a modern thing, but this is still what any Bat fan would have loved to have seen as a finale for the 60s TV series. And Allred gets the likenesses done so well, and he's got the feel of the show.
No, you don't have to guess.
No, that it really does feel like you got another episode of the 60s Batman. They've got the voices and just the narration and everything down. My hat's off to all the Allreds. This is for their Bat masterpiece. This just washed the taste of the bomb.
I know, you kept telling me, here's your palate cleanser. When you get finished, you know, I was...
Yeah, and I'm glad you liked it too, because I know you like the 60s, but it's more of you indulge me more in it. I mean, you like it from its, you know, because you grew up watching it too, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm a lot more into it than you are.
Well, obviously.
So I didn't know how you would, if you would like it, but I'm glad you liked it. So, I mean, yeah, if you only buy one, I know we covered the Two-Face special, the lost episode that Harlan Ellison had written. And that's a lot of fun too, and that's a good comic. But if you have to own one, if you only own one issue of Batman 66, get this one.
Yes.
And it was originally put out there digitally, so you can get the digital copy of it. And I think it was which one is that? It's chapter originally published online as Batman 66 Digital Chapter 72 and 73. And since this just came out, you should probably, I'm still looking up here for the date, and it's down here now, February 2016.
Right, so it's on newsstand.
It should be on the newsstand right now, and it's the last issue. Go out and buy it. It's $2.99. If you ever love the Batman 66 TV show, it's worth your $3 to buy this.
Yes.
Go out there and buy it.
I'm really thinking that we probably need to get another copy of this, because I think this is going to be one that you read and reread again.
Yeah, I might even put the cover in a frame or something and put it beside some of my Batman stuff.
Yeah.
That'd be cool to put the comic
in. I think that would be a good idea. We probably need to contact Steve Etherton at Heroes Realm in Lexington, which is our comic shop. There's your plug, Steve.
Yeah, we've recorded from there before. Yeah, me and Shaq have, yeah. So.
But, you know, we need to contact him. Tell him to drop Bombshells and give us another copy of that.
So... for more 60s Bat goodness, I want to direct you to the Bat Cave podcast if you aren't listening to it. John S. Drew has been going episode by episode with a special guest each episode talking about the series. He's in the third season right now, and if you keep your ears peeled, you might hear a familiar voice, me, on there soon. It'll be interesting, the episode we're going to discuss. I'll just put it to you that way. So, we talked third season Star Trek last time. The third season Batman's got a lot of the same vibe going about it. You know, there's like, despite everybody loving Yvonne Craig's Batgirl, the quality was kind of, you know, dipping there. But still, there's still some good stuff to be mined. And the Batcave podcast, it's just a great show. So definitely check it out. So we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finally cover your feedback from previous episodes.
Emergency. Batman speaking. Warning all of you to brace yourselves for big news.
The biggest.
Tell them, Robin.
Holy superlatives, Batman. It's really exciting.
Greetings, citizens. Join me, your old bat chum, John S. Drew, on my journey to discover what it is I love about the classic 1966 Batman television series on the Batcave podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by a guest host as we review the classic television series. There's a new episode every 2 weeks, same bat time, same bat channel, on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at thebatcavepodcast.com.
Holy memoranda, folks! Make a note not to miss it.
Good thinking, Robin.
Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast. A new monthly show chronicling the adventures of the JLI era by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. We'll be going issue by issue, in release order, tackling the core Justice League title, Justice League Europe, and the quarterly book. Along the way, we'll take time out for special episodes covering various spin-offs, cartoon appearances, the infamous TV pilot, and much more. So join me in an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we celebrate your favorite JLI members, such as...
Martian Manhunter.
Batman.
Dr. Fate.
Black Canary.
Fire.
Ice.
Maxwell Lord.
Oberon.
Captain Marvel.
Rocket Red.
Captain Atom.
Mr. Miracle.
Guy Gardner.
Booster Gold.
Blue Beetle.
Nort. And many, many more. Justice League International, Blahaha Podcast, coming March 2016 as part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Want to make something of it?
Okay, so we're back and we're going to dip into the old mailbag here. And we got a lot of feedback from our episode 43, Talking Crisis with Shag episode, as one would imagine, which was our last feedback episode. Gene Hendricks writes in and says, I have to side with Shag on this one. Well, forget it, Gene. I'm not going to read the rest of it. Yes, the after... Gene continues. Just kidding. Gene continues. Yes, the aftermath could have been handled better, but I think the Crisis on Infinite Earths was necessary and the advent of Legacy Heroes was worth it. Of course, I came into DC post-Crisis, so I'm a touch biased. Well, you know, you're a touch biased. I'm a touch biased the other way. So, you know, of course, Gene has been on the show before. He is of the Hammer Podcast and many fine Two True Freaks shows that you should be listening to. Some guy named Rob Kelly said, I listened to other podcasts to get away from Shag, and now this. Well, now we're all in the same network with Shag, so there's no escaping him. So there. He continues, the Shatner Turkey song was funny, especially all 17 minutes of it.
Hey, you know, when you can get... Danny has known the Deep Fried Turkey song since she was like 5 years old. She sings it all the time.
I can't watch Star Trek now without her bringing it up. And if it's a movie, she'll say, he's starting to look like Deep Fried Turkey Man now. So, there you go. William Shatner, my hero, is the Deep Fried Turkey Man to her. Okay.
Zeb Oswalt writes in, cool podcast as always, guys. Was fun to hear Shag on the show. I was a fanboy between the Crisis. So between the end of the Bronze Age and the start of Crisis, or pre-Crisis and post, so I was okay with the change. But New 52 makes me go, ugh, us too. And I count Spider-Girl as what happened to the true Spider-Man. I don't count the current Spider-Man. This is Earth 1 Peter to me. From One More Day and on Nope Parker, Peter Parker married Mary Jane and they gave birth to Mayday. So my Spider-Man died in Spider-Verse.
There you go. And obviously, so you guys have probably all heard this by now, but just today, you know, I've just, the last couple of days, we've learned that DC is apparently rebooting, or they're restarting over again with new number ones after issue number 52 of the New 52 launch titles in. So here we go again. Martin Gray writes in, enjoyable show, but poor Shag, to have not understood this is Earth 1 and this is Earth 2, bless. As for Burns Krypton, it took away a heck of a lot more than it added. No more exciting maps of Krypton replete with scarlet jungles and jewel mountains.
Good point. Shag wrote in to say, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
In any time.
Yep. We got an email from a new listener, Bradley Mann. He writes, hi, I came for Shag, but I will be going back to listen to at least the Starman stuff. I'm a huge Starman fan. Well, you've got good taste. Crisis was great. It was necessary. I was there. It was the new start that was needed. I wish the concept of multiple Earths had stayed. The new beginning should have been more complete. The little pieces that held on caused way too much trouble. I care about Infinity Incorporated. Thank you very much. I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge Earth 2 JSA fan, even the junior team. The Lantern Twins from the very start. Eventually Hector Hall as well. I missed the post-Crisis U, but it too had reached a tipping point. I was excited for the New 52 U for about 2 months. A relaunch was needed, just not this relaunch. Actually, I do like the new Earth 2, go figure. I love the concept of Legacy Heroes, but only if your characters are aging at close to a normal rate. When done right, Starman JSA, it works great. However, I actually think it hurt the Flash, as Jay aging while no other Flash did was weird. Now I'm going to listen to the second half of the podcast. Apparently, the crossover worked and you gained a new listener.
Woohoo!
Thank you very much. And he writes, P.S. A ploy to steal Marvel readers? OMG, it worked. That's when I switched. So there you go.
Another listener writes in, Michael Ridge. Hi, Earth 2 Chris. I enjoyed the discussion of Crisis on Infinite Earths discussion with Shag Matthews. I expected to still believe the Crisis was just a slap in the face to fans and the creators who had created the Earth 1 continuity. But Shag finally gave a decent reason for the Crisis. I never bought the too confusing to readers excuse that DC tried to sell. A combination of low sales for current books plus the inability to attract talent because the artists and writers didn't want to deal with the accumulation of baggage the characters had is a good reason for planning a restart. If DC had set out something like that reasoning, a restart would have been understandable to fans. As it was, I was angry that some of my favorites not only were destroyed by the Crisis, but had never even existed in the revised continuity. No hope of ever reading about them again. I guess that I now have to admit that the Crisis was necessary. Given that real-world reasons required some kind of restart, was there a way to do that without destroying the history?
Good points. Very good points. Jeff Nettleton wrote in, Hello, folks. I listened to the debate between Chris and Shag, and several valid points were made on both sides. Really, I think it boils down to which DC you started with. For me, it was the Bronze Age, with multiple Earths, particularly Earth 1 and Earth 2. I can see where someone coming into things in the 80s would say that Crisis brought a breath of fresh air, but I would argue that on a couple of points. One, DC had been undergoing radical changes with the ascent of Jeanette Kahn. She created an environment where new ideas were welcome while also paying tribute to the past, the Baxter reprints, the various book collections, etc. DC was hurting badly, and they basically took the gloves off and told people to run with good ideas. That gave us new Teen Titans, the revitalized Legion, Camelot 3000, and a revived Firestorm, Alan Moore on Swamp Thing, the British Invasion, etc. I would also argue that a lot of the creativity at DC came from places other than Marvel, two mainly, the independent scene in the UK. The independent world gave us people like Mike Baron, John Ostrander, Tim Truman, though he had done work for DC already, Matt Wagner, and some others. The UK gave them Alan Moore, Alan Davis, Dave Gibbons, Jamie Delano, John Wagner and Alan Grant, and Grant Morrison from the early wave. That enticed others like Neil Gaiman to follow. That had less to do with Crisis and more to do with the attitude at DC. Take a shot, we have nothing to lose. So now we come to the part of the argument that I have to concede to Shag. Well, I won't read that part. You can't easily do the revamped Superman and Wonder Woman in the existing environment. Those books underwent radical change. So, yeah. And, you know, as always, you know, he makes some fantastic points, Jeff does. And, you know, I mean, we really did get some great feedback on that and a lot of discussion. And you know, me and Shag were kind of playing around. I took more of the hard nose, it wasn't necessary thing. I think there was probably something necessary. I just, you know, kind of wish they hadn't thrown everything out. Of course, now it's like, it's barely a blip what they've done now, you know.
It's worse than soap operas.
To the characters, so. We actually got a follow-up message from email from Bradley Man. I'm about to drive for several long Thanksgiving lengthened hours. I like part one of your Starman series, so I have faith that the remaining parts will make the drive more enjoyable. Y'all like love Starman for all the same reasons I do. I'll be listening to all your stuff now. You are stuck with me as a listener. Thanks for making life more entertaining. That was very nice. You know, if we can make life more entertaining for, you know,
for somebody
for the hour or something, you know, that, because I, you know, podcasts help get me through my day. I mean, that's what I listen to at work. And I really appreciate it. Some days when you're having a really bad day at work. I mean, not even necessarily it's work. Just, you know, you're just worn out, tired, things going on, you know, just external things that you can't
control.
Dealing
with your wife.
No. I mean, I don't have those problems, really. But.
Good save.
Good answer. But podcasts help me get through the day. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I enjoy listening to them. And if we can do that for somebody else, that's the whole reason we're doing this. So, and because we just like to yak. Episode number 44 was the Robin 75th anniversary extravaganza. Rob Kelly writes, great episode. I miss Brave and the Bold so much. You and me both, brother. It ended way too soon.
Yes, most definitely.
Zeb Oswald wrote, cool podcast as always, guys. I wore a Robin costume 1 year as a kid. The whole year? Wow. The Earth 2 version. Now that's awesome. Because it had long pants. Tim Drake didn't exist yet. Jason was still Robin at the time. Dick Grayson was awesome in the role, though he became cooler once he became Nightwing. The spoiler was also good in the role of Robin. Too bad she didn't stay long as Robin. Can't wait to hear the next episode.
Martin Gray writes in, I'm listening out of order, so have just gotten to this. Really enjoying it, though I still dislike the music behind the recaps. It gets in the way. And was delighted to have Andrew on there.
Well, there you go. Andrew, you have a fan. You know, the music thing, I don't know. I try to keep it low so it doesn't interfere, but I don't know. I just can't help it. I got to put it back there. I got to, you know, make it more of a production. You know,
right.
I don't know.
Well, and if you ever notice, I mean, at our house, we always have music of some kind going on, you know.
Right.
It's always in the background. And I think that's just something we're just so used to.
Yeah.
We just
and I think,
through.
I mean, like, you know, I know in this episode, you know, the for the Batman 66 segment, we're going to have, I'm going to have the music playing in the background.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. I got to. I mean, I can't. It's compulsive. I can't not do it. I know that's a double negative, but I can't.
Well, you know.
But.
Okay. Jeff Nettleton writes in, "Hello, Franklin family. I've been out of town without internet for 2 weeks. Oh, bless your heart. We were recently without internet for 17 days, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
Oh, and got to listen to the most recent episode. Another triumph. It's fun to hear the whole family, if you include the disclaimer at the end, to talk about Robin and the BTAS, NBA, BATB, that's a lot of acronyms,
yep.
And comic adventures of the multiple Robins. Robin's has always been the side of Batman for me, having probably first seen the dynamic duo in the Filmation cartoons. Like you, most of my childhood saw Dick Grayson in college, working either alone or partnered with people other than Batman, i.e. the Teen Titans, Batgirl, etc. I've always enjoyed the character, especially as he grew into manhood. Dick Grayson, that is. Dick Grayson will always be Robin, and I prefer the Earth 2 idea that he continued using the Robin name into adulthood. The Nightwing name in New Teen Titans was of little consequence, since it was still Dick with the Titans. I didn't mind the costume. I still think it's overly criticized.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I applauded when Alex Ross had Dick Grayson back as Robin. Well, Red Robin
Young.
In Kingdom Come.
You said Red Robin, I said Yum.
It's like Dick finally came to terms with being Robin and found a way to both pay tribute to his mentor and be his own man.
You know, that's, I mean, I guess I was at the right age to accept Dick becoming Robin where I was a little bit younger, as long as he was, I guess I thought it was kind of cool because they needed to do something with him. He was too old to be running around in the original Robin costume. And I don't know, because we still had the Earth 2 Robin, so I was like, well, you know, he stays Robin and Dick becomes Nightwing. But when you took away the Earth 2 Robin, then it's like, well, now Dick Grayson's no longer Robin anywhere. You know, so I can see that, see his point. We got a lot of feedback for episode number 45, the Christmas Toys and TV Special, which I figured we would, because, you know, most people can relate to that are going to listen to this. Gene Hendricks writes again, "Now that was a walk down memory lane. I never had Migos, but Superpowers and He-Man were some of my top toys, right along with G.I. Joe, Transformers, and Star Wars. Where the secret origin of Santa Claus is concerned, I prefer the Rankin Bass, The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus. Maybe it fits better into my fantasy mindset than the other options." Well, I can see that. And I think Gene's just a hair younger than me, so I think that, you know, that plays into it too, yeah. So
Abel Padilla wrote in, "I was listening to this episode while Christmas shopping, so it was the perfect accompaniment. More so when I found a store at the mall that specialized in collector's toys." Ooh. We want to go.
Yep.
"Such a weird synchronicity. About the Migos, your talk about the Hulk reminded me how it used to bug me that he wasn't to scale with the other figures. He should have been bigger, not shorter."
Mm-hmm.
"He was also the one where the elastic inside used to break most often."
Mm-hmm.
"We got to learn about action figure construction with him. Good thing my mom was handy with a crochet hook."
Oh, that's good. I never thought about using a crochet hook to fix a Migo. I always had to use a pair of needle nose pliers. And my dad did, too, and he was cussing at him. But, yeah, the Hulk's often found broken in the package.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. He continues with another message. "Maybe you can explain on a future show how you think Hasbro and Paramount could connect Transformers, G.I. Joe, and Mask. This old-timer is curious about the new announcement today." Which, you know, they announced that all the Hasbro movie franchises are going to be tied in together. Which, I mean, honestly, I still think that they should have had the military outfit in the first Transformer movie be G.I. Joe. those guys should have just, or became G.I. Joe.
Right.
Because they were more G.I. Joe than the G.I. Joe in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I like them better. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the first G.I. Joe movie, just like, whoa. The second one's better, but it's still just, what? And Mask, well, you know, I guess they can make Mask at a branch of G.I. Joe or like another outfit that's connected somehow. Because they kind of did that when they integrated Matt Tracker, like we said, mm-hmm. into G.I. Joe. So, hey, Abel says, hey, one more thing I wanted to share. I remember having some of the Mego playsets, but after a while I needed some more adventure possibilities. One thing I did was to use a toss across as a death trap room.
That's cool.
That is awesome. My heroes would have to walk across it to get to the other side, and sometimes they didn't make it. That is very Batman 66.
Yes, it is.
That's awesome. I wish I'd had a toss across to do that with, because, yes, I probably would have done the exact same thing.
So Rob Kelly writes in, I kind of know that guy a little.
A little bit, yeah.
I love this episode. I have so many comments. I will try to remember them all as they came to me while I was listening. Who the heck did Mego Batman's voice? Ted Cassidy? I too had the Batcave, and it was a rad toy. I played with it all the time, and it held up pretty well from what I remember. The Joker always managed to find it via his Mego Joker mobile.
He had a Mego Joker mobile. I still don't have one.
I'm sorry, honey.
That's all right.
I love the sound of horror in Cindy's voice when realizing she'd married a redneck. Every day, baby, every day. As to Christmas specials, it's all Rankin Bass for me. I was so attached to their stop-motion stuff that I ignored any and all animated specials, even the ones by Rankin Bass. The Grinch and Peanuts were okay, too, of course, but those puppets were just the best.
And Rob and I actually discussed Mad Monster Party on the Film and Water podcast.
Oh, that's right. I appreciate Cindy giving Chris a hard time for picking on me regarding my Mego show for Fire and Water, which was, I don't know, over 50 episodes ago. Get over it, man!
Yeah, I gave him crap about him grabbing Brian Hyler for a Mego show before I had a chance to.
Give it up, baby.
I know.
We're not doing a Christmas show for Fire and Water this year, but sometime I should probably dig out the Rudolph Treasury editions, all 15 of them, and give them a look. He was quite the DC star back in the day.
Yes, he was. Kyle Benning, who has been on the show before, writes in, and of King Size Comic, Giant Size Fun, I listened to this fantastic episode on December 20th, and it occurs to me that I forgot to leave feedback. Well, you didn't forget, because now you did. I really enjoyed this episode. I really dug your format at tackling Christmas from both a geek toy perspective as well as Christmas special perspective. There were lots you guys mentioned that are regular favorites in our household as well. One thing I need to clarify, I did know that people called them AT-ATs. I just insist that the pronunciation is incorrect. They should follow the same pronunciation scheme as the ATST, and as such should be called out by the letter, i.e. ATATs. The only place that I can find they are ever called AT-ATs are on the vintage toy commercial, and come on, we know it's definitely possible that the marketing team responsible just flubbed it and rolled with it when the kid read the cue cards wrong.
I agree with that.
How would they know they were saying it incorrectly? It's never spoken on screen in the movies, and no one in their right mind would apply that same AT-AT pronunciation reasoning to the ATST. The AT-AT pronunciation shouldn't make it the canon pronunciation just because an 8-year-old said it wrong in 1980.
I see his point. C-3PO, R2-D2.
Yeah, they're not called Cithrobo.
I'm sorry, but I get him.
I do too. I honestly agreed with him, but it's just funny. Everybody does say AT-AT, but he's right. It's really wrong. Hope your family had a wonderful Christmas. We did. Have a great New Year's Eve, and I hope we get an episode of Supermates to hear all about your geeky hails from the holidays. Well, we've never really done that because the Leylands do it. They do it on Hey Kids Comics. So it's like, you know, I don't want to steal their shtick. That's too much their thing. So, so we've just never really done that. We mentioned it in passing. I think I mentioned it some. Zeb Oswald writes, cool podcast as always. I remember getting the G.I. Joe from the Action Team line with the Arrowhead necklace and beard, along with the Tonka truck, and quite a few Superman and Spider-Man action figures, and G.I. Joe, a Real American Hero line. I got the Stalker toy. Thought he was cool. He was a Ranger and came with a grease gun. Well, it was a rifle that shot 45 rounds in World War II, but was replaced by the M16. I liked the grease gun better as a kid, and I did get the Star Wars Death Star playset with the garbage chute level in it. And that weird monster that almost killed Luke in the movie. Can't wait to hear the next podcast. So, man, you had some serious cred with that Death Star playset. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, that thing is, you know, it's the shizzle. So, that's awesome. Yeah, and I always liked Stalker, too. I was kind of, he was pretty prominent in the first comic. He was in the early comics and the first TV miniseries, but then they kind of stuck him to the side, you know.
Van Z writes in, fun episode. It brought back memories of Christmas Migos. 3 3/4 Dukes, Batmobile, Mean Machine, Stretch Monster, Evil Knievel, $6 Million Man, Atari 2600. I can't believe I never thought of the Mr. Spock Namor Migo idea. That's pure genius.
I peaked early. That was one thing I did in life, and that was it.
Jeff Nettleton writes in, Merry Christmas, Franklin family. I was listening to the recent podcast and enjoying the memories, though every time you mentioned how old you were when you got certain toys, my hair, what's left, grew a little grayer. I had a few of those 70s toys you mentioned, though I always seem to get that kind of stuff more for birthdays than Christmas. In my household, it was the JCPenney Christmas catalog, not the Sears Wish Book. Don't know why, it's just the way it was. We used to pore over that thing, though we rarely got what we asked for. I think we tended to pick a little too expensive for a teacher's salary. We did pretty well from time to time, though. I had the Evil Knievel stunt cycle and got the stunt van for Christmas. However, that year, we were in Florida. I grew up in Illinois for a relative's wedding anniversary. It was also a family vacation that included the relatively new Disney World. Yes, I'm older than Disney World. Back when we went, it was in the middle of nowhere. Anyway, we had Christmas in a motel room, and I woke up that morning to find the van. My mom brought along my stunt cycle, but she couldn't find Evil. Instead, she brought my amigo Dr. Zaius from the Planet of the Apes line. Looking back, that should have been so cool. Daredevil rider Dr. Zaius. Instead, it was just weird, especially since you couldn't wedge the figure onto the cycle.
That is all kinds of awesome because not only did you have Christmas at Disney World and get the Evil Knievel scramble van, which is just freaking awesome, but you invented Dr. Zaius on a motorcycle. And I'm all but certain that there is a rack toy in our buddy Brian Heiler's rack toy book that the AHI made that has Dr. Zaius on a motorcycle. So it's not without precedent. It's completely wrong, but it's not without precedent.
Well, there you go.
So we got some feedback from episode number 46, which was Michael Bailey's guest spot talking about the Hulk episode, the first. And Zeb Oswalt writes again, cool podcast as always. So wait, it was Hulk versus Swamp Thing. Good job on y'all's coverage of the episode. The TV show was great. I enjoyed the TV movies as well when I was younger, save the Thor one. The DD one was great. Y'all and Mike made a great team up. Can't wait to hear the next podcast. Well, thank you, and we definitely enjoyed that.
Andrew Leyland writes in. I just, you know, like him.
Christmas. Don't pick favorites.
Sorry. Chris and Cindy, really enjoyed your look at the Incredible Hulk TV episode, The First, one of the more memorable and interesting segments of the series. The First is a really important episode in the mythology of the show that I would presume would have come into play had the series got the finale Ken Johnson wanted. The episode threw up some interesting discussion, but what tickled my ivories was your discussion of the pre-credit teaser trailers that aired before the show. Over here in the UK, these were always cut off the imported shows we watched, with a few exceptions. Mostly, I suspect this was due to the fact that whether the show aired on the BBC or ITV, neither network had adverts immediately after the opening credits, so there was no real need to try and hook the viewer in that way. I remember thinking it was really weird when I learned that over in the US, you had a commercial break after the opening credits. Yes, and it's also annoying, Andrew.
Yes.
Someone in the UK TV production department had a real problem with teasers and cold opens generally, though. Over on the BBC, the cold open of shows like Star Trek and Mission Impossible were re-edited to appear after the opening credits. The first time I saw a Star Trek as it was meant to be seen was when the videos were released in the late 80s. The teasers are largely redundant, but there are quite a few of them that have scenes in them that are not present in the episode itself. I can think of episodes of Magnum P.I. and Airwolf that this applies to. Anyway, this was a great episode. Somebody needs to dedicate a podcast to the Incredible Hulk TV show, and only real life gets in the way of me doing it. Best to all, Andy.
Do it, man. Do it.
Do it.
Do it, and then have me on a few times. Yeah, that's really interesting. I know that they don't show commercials in the middle of programs, on the BBC, and you know, because Doctor Who is, you know, that's why there's the commercial breaks in modern Doctor Who, just like makes you scratch your head. Why is this commercial break like this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, that's not a break, you know, where they're tailored to breaks here. But I didn't know that about, you know, it makes sense though, because if you know that, then you should realize that those cold openings and title sequences, the way they're cold opening, title sequence, and then the body of the show are here, that wouldn't work there, but I just never thought of it before. Jeff Nettleton writes again, "Hello folks, I've been listening to the latest episode with Michael Bailey and the Incredible Hulk two-parter, The First. I was not a regular watcher of The Hulk since it was on CBS. Where I grew up in Illinois, the CBS affiliate was about 70 miles away and our TV wouldn't tune into it very well. So I didn't get to see a lot of CBS TV until we got a better set, no antenna on the house either. I only got to see The Hulk if we were at a relative's house, like when I got to see the Mariette Hartley one. I saw some of it in syndication in high school. I don't think I ever saw this one or no more than a few minutes. It actually sounds like one I would have enjoyed. You mentioned Lola Albright and feeling that you should recognize her. Looking over her IMDb resume, two things stand out. The first is an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show, How to Spank a Star. Sounds like something to be on the Lonely Hearts Romance podcast that Siskoid does on the Fire and Water Network. Ding. Plug. She plays a character named Paula Marshall, who is a guest star on the Alan Brady Show. She is so difficult and demanding that Mel ends up not producing the show, and she maneuvers Rob into the role. Rob can't handle her until he sees Laura deal with similar spoiled behavior with Richie. Rob ends up threatening her with suing her for breach of contract if she doesn't perform the script as set or walks off the set, and she caves. She is very memorable for being attired in a leotard for a good portion of the episode, and she wants to do a pseudo striptease behind Alan Brady in a sketch, which Rob hates. The other is an episode of Columbo. She plays a producer who is blackmailing her star actor, played by William Shatner, who is portraying a detective on TV. Shatner murders her and thinks he has gotten away with it until he is forced to match wits with Lieutenant Columbo." That sounds very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Jeff continues, "Sorry, slight PS. You guys mentioned Brad, the old bully from Superman 3, played by Gavin O'Harely.
Harely.
He was the original Chuck Cunningham. He was replaced later in the episode where Richie borrows Chuck's apartment. He's also a soldier who knows Val Kilmer in Willow. He's also the son of Dan
O'Harely,
the head of OCP in the RoboCop films. Grig, the alien navigator in Last Starfighter and narrator of many commercials of the 90s, and a decent character actor of the 50s and 60s. I always had a theory about the disappearance of Chuck Cunningham." We need to do a podcast just about theories of Chuck Cunningham. I'm telling you, everybody has their own. But anyway.
This is a good one.
Yes. My theory is that he does his time in the Army, it was the draft era, and is recruited into the CIA, who then erases any record of his past. The Cunninghams can never mention him and act like he never existed. Then he ends up in Vietnam in the Phoenix program, where he encounters one Private Theodore Cleaver, since there was an urban legend that Jerry Mathers died in Vietnam. I have this vision of sometime in the future in the 70s where investigative journalist Richard Cunningham is looking into some of the CIA activities and stumbles across his long-missing brother. Take care, Jeff."
Well, Richie could run into Carl Kolchak, and they could investigate it together. Maybe. You know, we should have an episode where we discuss the characters that disappeared from TV shows. You can have Chuck Cunningham. You can have Donna's sister from that 70s show. You can have like half the cast of the Urkel show. What was the name? Family Matters?
Yes.
They ended up disappearing over time. Like one would disappear and then eventually the others disappeared.
I know, like Richie, the little guy, and her little sister, and you know.
And eventually Richie's mom, the aunt that was the girl off of Good Times that was in Tony Orlando and Dawn. They all disappeared, you know. And so that, you know what it was? Rip Hunter picked them up. They were the first Legends of Tomorrow, and it went horribly wrong.
Oh, good job. Good job.
Which, that wasn't bad. That wasn't bad. No.
As we record that was just on just a few days ago.
Yeah, it was just on a few days ago. The premiere wasn't bad. It was a little rushed, but it was, you know, it was like very comic booky, you know, so it was very fun. And kind of Doctor Who-y, so. Doctor Who-y, that's a word. Rob Kelly writes in, "Dang, I forgot to comment on this episode, as I am contractually obligated to. Fun as always, and Michael Bailey is a ringer as a guest." Yeah, he brings the rain, you know. So, I of course loved the Hulk show, watched it religiously. I never knew all the backstage shenanigans, which goes a long way to explaining why old Greenskin so rarely found himself fighting anyone within a country mile of his power set. It's too bad they never got a chance to do a final episode, leaving us with those horrendous TV movies. By the time the last one came around, I was watching purely out of nostalgia, but it still bothered me it ended with Hulk Banner dead, not cured. Bah! Agreed.
Agreed.
Yeah. We just in, as right before we record this, we got feedback on episode 47, which was our Star Trek Paradise Syndrome episode, from Jeff Nettleton.
Oh, wow. I haven't read this one yet.
Okay.
Again, this is from Jeff Nettleton. Hello, folks. I'm always up for a podcast discussing classic Trek, even cheesy classic Trek. But man, I used to hate the tree-hugging hippie episodes in my best Cartman imitation.
Tree-hugging hippie!
Maybe it's because these tended to be slow episodes, especially when I was young. Maybe it was because I got enough of that on things like Room 222 or The Partridge Family, or the warped versions on The Brady Bunch. Or maybe it was because, as you said, it brings out the ham and Shatner. You know, for a Jew, Shatner's acting isn't very kosher. That's so wrong. Oh, my goodness.
William Shatner for Hebrew National Hot Dogs.
Oh, go on. You do the next paragraph. Oh, dear.
I can appreciate, and this is Jeff again, I can appreciate some of this more as an adult, and you bring up some interesting points. Still, I like my Trek to have a bit more action and adventure, which is why my third season favorites were things like Day of the Dove and the Enterprise Incident. Sword fights with Klingons and Cold War parallels were a lot more fun. And we got a few general comments. I always forget to look on Facebook on the side. People just kind of post directly to, and I always forget to look that, so I apologize. Some of these are from
Ever ago.
So we got one from Jeffrey Fishback. Just found your podcast. Heard you two on Disney Indiana podcast talking Star Wars. And being a Star Wars geek and overall geek, I thought I'd check your podcast out, and I'm loving it. You two remind me of me and my lovely wife. Keep up the great work. Well, thanks for stopping by. And it's nice
and to keep on stopping.
Yeah, keep on stopping. And it's nice to know that our little trip to Disney Indiana brought a listener. And of course, keep listening to Disney Indiana because I love that show. But okay.
CJ Glickman wrote in August. Sorry, this is late. Just found your podcast. I heard about it on the Hammer podcast. I started with the Kathy Lee Crosby episode, and now I'm listening to the Linda Carter episode. It's a good podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Harlan Freelecker wrote in, loving the podcast. He wrote back in July the 4th. Loving the podcast. I've been listening to the episodes piecemeal, but I've only got a few left until I'm totally caught up. Your opening sequences would serve as a pretty good summary of my marriage, too. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing there, Harlan, but, you know.
Oh, I think it's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing, yeah.
You know, 20 years can't be too wrong.
So you were, you know, High Father. Actually, Isaiah, the High Father, actually performed your ceremony. Well, I think that'll do it for that. So we had some extreme lows and extreme highs with that episode.
Yeah.
So I don't know what we're going to do next time. We're still planning the 50th anniversary, or not 50th anniversary. We're still planning episode number 50.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll definitely have something fun for you next time. So thanks for listening, and be sure to check out all the other fine Fire and Water Network podcasts. And we'll see you later. Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright by respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at our blog at supermatescomic.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates Podcast. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Have you seen any unusual looking people around here? I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky, slam, bam, zowie and wham.
old crooks came by. I was singing a song, drinking in sunshine, acting as friendly as could be. Crunch, plop, crack, and plop, they threw their curves at me. Somebody yelled, "Hey, Batman, what are you waiting for?" With a zap and a crack, I began my attack. After that, they were flat on the floor. So I'm walking along, carefully watching, in case they should make another try. Zonk, pow, here they are now, out of an orange-colored sky. Crooks, beware. I'll pursue every clue that'll lead me to you. I'll let you stay, but you must change your way. Anytime there's a crime, I'll be there. I was walking along, minding my business. Love came and hit me in the eye. Scoot, scat, just like a bat out of an orange. Come.